You may have heard of the man who was shipwrecked. He was the only survivor of a shipwreck, and he ended up washing up onto this uninhabited island. Well, the first thing that he did was to painstakingly make this shelter for himself, and he used driftwood. He even used parts of the broken-up ship, and he was very proud of it. Well, for weeks, he lived in that shelter, and he would pray that God would rescue him, and he'd watch the horizon looking for ships, and none ever came. Well, one day, after returning from his search for food around the little island, he was horrified to find his shelter up in flames. Somehow his campfire had spread, and oh, he was just devastated. He was depressed. He was upset with God, and he started thinking that all hope was lost. He just went to sleep right there on the sand. Well, he awoke the next morning by the voice of a man who was a captain of a ship who explained to him, "We saw your smoke signal, and we came to rescue you." Obviously, the point is, what may seem like a disaster may be a smoke signal leading to our deliverance. What may seem like the worst thing may turn out, one day turn into the best thing, or if not the best thing, at least something that is good. Romans 8:28. So just to kind of give you a minor illustration, I'm sure some of you have better ones. When I was trying to get out of California and I was looking for a place to go, well, I found this congregation in Colorado that I thought was perfect for my family. I was sure that it was a gift from God. Everything just seemed to fall into place. Well, a bunch of people applied for the position, and it got down to me and this other guy, and I thought that I just hit it out of the ballpark. Oh, I was sure of it, and yet he got it. And I was like, "God, what's the deal?" And I was so upset, and I just couldn't understand it. And of course, I was still stuck in California. But looking back, okay, I believe this is a better congregation and actually a better place for my family to be. On top of that, I learned a lot from that experience. I think that I needed it. See, if you look up the word providence in the dictionary, you'll find something like the foreseeing care and guidance of God, a manifestation of divine care or direction. This life, it can be pretty scary at times, and we cannot always see the hand of God in the midst of our difficult circumstances. So sometimes it seems that things that just couldn't get any worse, and there's no way out, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. But if we will learn to trust God and obey Him and allow Him to use us as His servants, I believe that it will all work out in the end. And you know what? He may even accomplish some great things for His kingdom through us. Well, if you would, let's turn back to the book of Esther. So today we're going to finish our study through this good book. Well, as I said last week, the Jews, they have this celebration each year, and it's called the Feast of Purim. It means the casting of lots. And it commemorates when the lot was cast against the Jews and Esther stood up and saved her people. And they still observe it today. And from what I understand, the book of Esther is read twice at two different times, once on Purim Eve and then again on Purim Day. Well, the events in this book, they took place during the Medo-Persian Empire, sometimes called the Achaemenid Empire. And our story is based in Susa, the capital. Susa, that was the winter residence of the Persian kings. And you can see it there on the map in present-day Iran. And the king was Ahasuerus. Some versions use his Greek name, Xerxes. Now, Ahasuerus, he was a few kings down from Cyrus. And that was the guy who told the Jews that they could go home, you know, from their exile. And if you go on Google Earth, you can actually zoom in to the ruins of his palace, which was huge. And you can even see where the king's gate was located, which is mentioned a few times. Well, last week, okay, in chapter 1, we read how the king threw a party and how Queen Vashti refused to come and to display herself before the drunken men of Susa. She was then removed from being queen because she didn't obey the king. In chapter 2, after returning home from his failed attempt at conquering Greece, well, they decided to have something of a national beauty contest to fill his harem and to see who should take Vashti's place as queen. Well, among the many different women, a Jewish woman named Esther was taken. And it says of her, the young woman was beautiful of form and face. And so she was a 10, as some people put it. As I'm always trying to tell my daughters, okay, it's nice to look good on the outside. And I think we're supposed to take care of ourselves. But it's much more important to look good on the inside. Proverbs 31:30, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, or fleeting, as the NIV says. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. We learn that she had been raised by her older cousin Mordecai after her parents died. Well, amazingly, the king, he loved Esther, and this Jewish orphan girl became the queen of an empire that was comprised of more than half of the known world. Now, if this was a fairy tale, okay, it would have ended there with the words, and they lived happily ever after. But this is real life, all right? The story's just getting started. Something to remember is that Mordecai, he seems to have been either a guard or, well, he had some kind of job at the king's gate. And one day he uncovered a plot to assassinate the king. Well, Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name, and sure enough, it was found to be true. Well, in chapter 3, we're introduced to the bad guy, Haman. Now, in the Purim celebrations today, whenever his name is read, they make a bunch of noise with these things called graggers, which they spin around. Probably, I mean, I assume it's to give the kids something to do, keep them interested. It's kind of like how we would say, boo. Well, guess what? After last week's sermon, I ordered one online. And so, let me demonstrate. Haman! Haman! Imagine an entire room of people doing this, okay? It's very wild. Now, they also eat these cookies, which are sometimes called Haman's ears. Sort of look like an ear. Well, Haman, okay, he had come into a position where he was second in command to the king. And the king had ordered that everyone was to bow down to Haman. Oh, Haman, he was extremely egotistical. And so he loved it, to be sure. But Mordecai, no, he refused to bow down to him. And like good little gossips, there were some of the king's servants who went to Haman to tell him that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him, and it was because he was a Jew. Well, Haman, he was so mad about this that he decided that he wanted to kill all of the Jews because of it. He was willing to wipe out an entire race of people because one man in a multitude would not bow down to him. It is amazing what Satan can talk people into. And so Haman had them cast lots before him to find out what was the best day to kill the Jews. And that's where the name Purim comes in. It was kind of like throwing dice. And the lot fell to about a year from that time. So Haman, he went to the king, and he knew exactly how to manipulate him. And without even asking who the people were or what they had done, the king simply gave Haman his signet ring to make it a law. And the laws of Media and Persia, now, they could not be repealed once they were made. Well, chapter 4, well, since he couldn't just call or text her, we have this really interesting dialogue between Mordecai and Esther through one of the king's eunuchs. And Mordecai gave her a copy of the edict and told her everything that had happened and that she must go to the king and to plead with him for her people. And it's not a small matter to speak against the king's right-hand man, but the real problem is that it was illegal to go before the king without being summoned. It could result in your death if he did not extend the golden scepter. Now, on top of that, she's kind of wondering about her relationship with the king. He hadn't summoned her in 30 days. And keep in mind, they're no longer newlyweds at this point. They'd been married about 5 years. Well, she was very reluctant at first, but Mordecai explained to her that she may have attained royalty for such a time as this. As I mentioned last week, we may be where we are at, not by coincidence, but by providence. And God wants to use us in our situation. Well, she then said, "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." Many people would have concluded, "No, let someone else save the Jews. I don't want to risk my life." But Aunt Esther, she decided that she was going to do it no matter what. If a guard was commanded to drive a sword through her body, she would die doing what she knew was right. This is chapter 5, Esther's banquet. Let's start our reading in verse 1. "Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace." So she's standing there in the court, not knowing what's going to happen to her. Now let me just throw this in here. Isn't it great to be a Christian? We don't have that kind of fear when going before our God and king. Well, the king looked over and he saw one fine looking woman. And he said, "That there is my wife. Come on in here, Queenie Pooh," or something like that. And sure enough, he extended the golden scepter to her. Now, when you hear golden scepter, I assume you envision something like the jewel-encrusted scepter of Queen Elizabeth. But we do not have to guess as to what the scepter of Ahasuerus looked like. So here's an ancient relief of either him or his father, and there are others like it. You'll notice that he has a lotus flower in his left hand and a long, thin scepter in his right. It's pretty basic. All right, just had a ball at the top. Verse 3. "Then the king said to her, 'What is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you.' Esther said, 'If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him.'" You know, maybe she had heard the saying that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. "Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires.' So the king and Haman came to the banquet, which Esther had prepared. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, 'What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. What is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done.' So Esther replied, 'My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says.'" Okay, the king knew perfectly well that she had not yet said what she wanted to say. See, have you ever gone somewhere with the intention of putting forward a very important question or comment or request, but when the moment came, you choked, and you decided to just put it off and try again? Now, whether she temporarily lost her courage and chickened out, or that was her plan from the beginning, the delay, as we're going to see, worked out perfectly. It also makes for some suspenseful reading, which I like. Well, after the feast, Haman, you know, on his way home, he's going home, he's in high spirits. He had just gone to this feast with the king and queen, and he was the only one invited. But he saw Mordecai in the king's gate, who, of course, didn't show him any respect. And it says in verse 9 that he was, quote, filled with anger against Mordecai. Well, we're then introduced to Haman's wife and friends, who some people think were even creepier than he was. So let's read here verses 10 through 13. "Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, 'Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. What a poor, miserable wretch. He had all of those blessings, but he couldn't see past Mordecai. He had absolutely everything on earth that he wanted, but all of his blessings were obscured because of one petty annoyance. Don't let that happen to you. Verse 14. Then Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now again, the original language, it could be referring to hanging, impalement, or crucifixion. Okay, that's like 75 feet high. You know, a six-story building, you think of. Some scholars, they think it's just hyperbole. Others, though, they think that the gallows, they were possibly erected on top of the city walls or on a hillside or something like that. But whatever it was, he obviously wanted everyone to see. See, I think it's like that old saying, hang him as high as heaven. And so, well, he had his carpenters get to work and, you know, putting up the gallows, which I'm sure was music to his ears, listening to all the construction noises. He couldn't wait a year. He couldn't wait that year for Haman to die with the rest of the Jews. You talk about an egomaniac. But as Proverbs 16:18 says, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And so chapter 6, Ahasuerus's insomnia. The verse 1, it says, "During that night, the king could not sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king." See, I guess his life was so boring that it helped to put him to sleep. My mother would always give me warm milk with nutmeg when I couldn't sleep, but you know, maybe he had already tried that. Well, verse 2, "It was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. The king said, 'What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?' Then the king's servants who attended him said, 'Nothing has been done for him.'" Anyway, we read about that incident in the end of chapter 2. So he recognized that Mordecai had saved his life. It was just about everything else in this book. That sure was some good timing on the insomnia and the section that was read to him. Mere coincidence? That's hard to think so. And just as a side, you see, sometimes we'll do good things like Mordecai that go unappreciated, but the Lord knows, Hebrews 6:10. And every now and then, something like this will happen. Verse 4, "So the king said, 'Who is in the court?' Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, 'Behold, Haman is standing in the court.' And the king said, 'Let him come in.' So Haman came in, and the king said to him, 'What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?' And Haman said to himself, 'Whom would the king desire to honor more than me?'" See, old big head thought that the king was speaking of him. So what did he say? I like the VeggieTales version of it. "This sounds like the kind of guy who deserves a parade. I think this guy should be dressed in royal robes and march through the whole city on your horse. And maybe you should even let him wear one of your crowns. And one of your most noble princes should lead this man through the streets proclaiming, 'This is a really neat guy. The king really likes him. He's brave and has rugged good looks.'" It's pretty close, actually. So what happened? Well, verse 10. "Then the king said to Haman, 'Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting in the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of what you have said.'" Can you imagine his face? I wish I could have seen it. As you know, it just went downhill from there. There are consequences for evil actions, you reap what you sow. I mean, definitely at the judgment day, but also many times during this life. You see, evil that you deal out is often like a boomerang that comes back to hit you. Not always, but often. And the Proverbs talk a lot about that. You know, Haman, he should have taken the time to read them. And so should we. Well, after he had done what he was commanded by the king, and after he had returned home, you know, with his head covered in shame, Haman's wife reckoned that this was the beginning of the end, and made a very interesting statement in verse 13. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. I don't know. Maybe she had recently come across some of the stories like of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Daniel in Babylon, whose enemies ended up in the lion's den, you know, after he survived it. Well, however she came to this conclusion, Haman's wife was right. Verse 14, it then says, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So chapter 7, Haman's end. Verse 1. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. And King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he who would presume to do this? Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And so check this out. The man who was so mad about the Jew Mordecai not bowing down before him was now himself bowing down before the Jew Esther. Well, the king, he put the worst possible construction on it and said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? Well, one of the eunuchs in verse 9 said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So sure enough, he had Haman hanged on the gallows that Haman had prepared for Mordecai. God's will or promises cannot be thwarted by the actions of evil men. See, an unalterable Persian law, that's nothing for God. A seemingly dead end, no, it's not always that with God on your side. And that brings us to chapters 8 and 9, the Jews' victory. So here we find the happy ending. Verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So, see, Esther was given the estate of Haman, which she gave to Mordecai to take care of, and Mordecai was given Haman's position. Well, the king, he could not revoke the death order for the Jews, but he did what he could, and he wrote a counter decree to help them protect themselves. Verse 15. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. In each and every province and in each and every city where the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So the Jewish nation, it was stronger, it was more unified than ever. So even making many new converts, proselytes to Judaism. Well, chapter 9, all right, a bunch of people came to the aid of the Jews, and they ended up killing 75,000 of their enemies throughout the empire. And even Haman's 10 sons, they were hanged as well. I mean, they may have been just as bad as their father. But regardless, a lot of people died because of Haman's hubris. There's your word of the day. See, hubris means excessive pride and arrogance. Chapter 9, it finishes with the institution of the Feast of Purim for the Jews. All right, let's finish up here. Chapter 10, Mordecai's greatness. So verse 1 mentions how Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land. It may have been done to pay for the Grecian war defeat that happened in between chapters 1 and 2, or for his construction program in Persepolis that he was starting. Well, verse 2, and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with his many kinsmen. One who sought the good of his people, and who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. Well, Ahasuerus, you know, Xerxes, he reigned for 20 years before being assassinated. And from what I've read, the Medo-Persian Empire just kept going downhill. 331 BC, the empire came to an end with Alexander the Great's victory at Gaugamela in Mesopotamia. And of course, we find prophecies about their end in the book of Daniel. Well, Mordecai's name, it has indeed been found on ancient clay tablets excavated from over there, which, I mean, it's up for debate, but many people believe it's referring, sure enough, to the biblical Mordecai. And that, of course, is what you want from a leader, isn't it? One who sought the good of his people and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. Is the leader in it for himself or for his people? Now, that's true, whether it's the leader of a nation, a city, a business, a club, a family, or a church. So, okay, what is the conclusion? Don't be a Haman. No, that's not my conclusion, but it is good advice. So many wonderful things happened because of Esther's courage and God on her side. Something we see over and over in the Bible is that God's people are not to be smothered by fear. If I perish, I perish. As I asked last week, could you have done that? Will you do that? It may not be if I perish, I perish. But it may be if I'm fired, I'm fired. Or if I'm unfriended, I'm unfriended. Will you and I do and say what is right no matter what? I mean, what's it going to be for you and me? Peace and popularity or preaching? Tiptoe and tolerance or truth? Will we worry about our own skin and what everyone else thinks about us over what God thinks? See, as Joshua put it, we're going to have to choose whom we are going to serve. If I perish, I perish. Of course, Jesus said that, and he did end up perishing. But what happened to him is the greatest example of God causing all things to work together for good. With God on our side, there may be tough times. There may be some pretty rough times, but the end of the story will always be the same. Romans 8, 28. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. There were just a tremendous amount of coincidences in the book of Esther. Remember, God is not even mentioned in the book. But God is always present. He is always at work, whether we know it or not, whether we feel him or not. And God can take what we would consider to be negative or even terrible situations and turn them around for his glory. I mean, think of how bleak things looked in the book of Esther. It's been said that God is the God of the crisis as well as the calm. See, we often praise him in the calm, right? When things are going really well. But when we're in a crisis, we're like, where's God? Now, he's still there. He's still present whether we are in peace or a predicament. As it's been said, it's going to be okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. And so let's remember that for this week.